Hello, this is Joe from the Talking Information Center. Today I will be reading articles and other selections from Harper's Magazine, February 2025 edition. Today's first selection is an essay entitled Hope Strings Paternal by Julie Bunton from I Was So Hopeful for You, collected in the anthology What My Father and I Don't Talk About, which will be published in May by Simon & Schuster. Before my father sent me the email I'd been waiting for my entire life, I tried to solicit it. He left us when I was just a baby, maintaining little contact with me, but it wasn't until college that I felt brave enough to try and get his attention. I got his email address from my aunt, sent a long, gooey letter about how I couldn't know myself if I didn't know him. I wasn't like my mother, my siblings. Some part of me had always felt out of place, desperate to please people, to prove myself. Was he the answer? Eventually, he wrote back a paragraph in response to my five. He said he liked all foods but chicken pot pie and ignored most of my other questions. I replied anyway. He didn't answer. Every now and then, I'd initiate this type of exchange, feeling the same combination of hope and preemptive humiliation when I hit send. Once, he responded from a different email address. It belonged to a woman, and when I Googled her, I found that she was his colleague and young. Her Facebook profile was only semi-private. In one of her pictures, my father carried a small blonde boy on his shoulders, both of them squinting toward the sun. I kept tabs on him that way from then on, through Google searches I conducted more often than I want to admit, clicking the same results over and over. The sepia-toned photo from the summer camp he'd attended as a kid, his girlfriend's Facebook page. I wondered if he also searched for me. Surely he must think of me sometimes. As far as I knew, I was his only biological child. And yet, it was strange how he'd answer via his girlfriend's email, as if he were trying to make it harder, not easier, for me to reach him. During my junior year, my laptop broke. Asking my mother to help was not an option. I waitressed a few shifts a week at an Italian place in Midtown, earning cash that New York City promptly ate. I wrote to my father and asked if he could co-sign a $3,000 private loan. I didn't consider just asking for the laptop, or only for what the laptop would cost. Fair or not, I felt I was owed more. One of my mother's stories, after all, was that my father, wherever he was, had plenty of money. After some deliberation, he agreed. The paperwork was full of fascinating information, his birthday, for example, which I'd never known, his address in Michigan, his middle name. We talked on the phone. I learned he'd been in New York recently. It had not occurred to me to seek him out. It had not occurred to him to seek me out. He must not have thought I would have expected him to. "Interesting place," he said, or something along those lines, but I couldn't live there. It was the most straightforward evidence I'd ever gotten that my yearning for closeness was not reciprocated. A few years later, I fell behind on my loan payments, and I received a terse message from him about credit and how it works. I responded childishly, and he wrote back within hours. It was thrilling to learn, finally, how to get him to pay attention to me. The closing line of his last response still rattles around in my head. "I was so hopeful for you, and now that does not seem to be the case at all. It was a happy time in my life, a span of years I'd go back to if someone gave me the chance. I made $34,000 a year working for a literary nonprofit, but I was writing a book, closing in on that first draft. I had interesting friends and a partner I loved. I was 26, and everything out of the reach had started to seem possible. the furious, smoking girl I'd once been who tried to ruin my life. I thought I'd killed her, or at least converted her to, and her self-destructive impulses into ambition. But it seemed that in his mind, she lived on. A door I'd been holding open for him swung shut. That was a relief to let it. The first time I saw my son, really saw him, he was in a plastic box and trussed with wires and tubes, like a chicken from outer space. My husband was sitting next to the box, his sterilized hand poking through a hole in the box's side. One of the baby's tiny fists was curled around my husband's finger. "Isn't he cute?" my husband said, his voice breaking. The two of them had claimed each other already. Black matter moved through the tubes coming out of the baby's mouth. That was the meconium, I was told. "Yes," I said, as if from a great distance away. I waited to feel a surge of something, love or simple recognition. We had brought three names with us to the hospital, and I could barely remember what they were. Baby Bunton, the doctors called the baby in the box. Bunton. Someone was already wheeling me away back to my room so I could attach my breasts to the giant machine and extract colostrum to feed baby Bunting. When they let me give him some. "I just never bonded with you," my father had once confessed. I couldn't get that line out of my head in the weeks to come, even though the dissociation I'd felt after the baby's birth disappeared the instant I held him for the first time, masked up in the NICU room with its glass walls, careful not to dislodge the CPAP machine secured to his head with what looked like a large rubber band. His face had a crease in it, right at the top of his nose, from being squished up in my belly, and we both had blotchy and splotchy purple skin from his oxygen issues. Maybe mine from bursting from so many blood vessels pushing him out. My husband and I gave him a name. We took him home where my mother had cleaned our house and hung a welcome home banner, made me dozens of oatmeal cookies that I'd eat two or three at a time in the middle of the night between breastfeeding sessions, hungrier than I'd ever been while pregnant. That cold confusion that gripped me when I first looked at baby Bunton, was that, or something like it, what my father had felt? It was terrifying to imagine that feeling extending for days, weeks, months, as the baby grew more and more alert, reaching out for things, as my son was doing with his perfect webby fingers, fixing his little gaze on our faces. The same part of me that had wanted to impress my father in college tried to understand it, to rationalize it, but I couldn't. I was falling down the rabbit hole in the other direction. In the days after my baby was born, everything that had once burned for me dimmed. It was replaced instead with the irrefutable brightness of him, my son, with his huge black eyes and his bread and milk smell, trying with every ounce of his will to lift his head off the floor. Oh, is there anything more impossible than writing about why you love your own baby? I couldn't believe him sometimes, even when he was in my arms, that he was mine, that I belonged so essentially to this family I had made myself. Bonding seemed too remote a concept. The two of us were one. When other people held him, I stared at them until they gave him back. All my life, I felt so hungry. As a child, I was watching other people with their families. As an adult in New York City clawing for a foothold, I ate too much, drank too much, exercised too much, worked too much, trying to perfect the self, trying to fill some yawning pit of need, always desperate for more of everything, as if in some fundamental way I'd never gotten enough of what? Whatever a father gives a daughter when he stays. But when I held my son, I felt full. All that wanting, gone. It was earth-shattering and like a little death. At first, I thought I'd been simply wrong. Wrong with everything. What if babies for me were the thing, not writing, teaching, making art? Books had nothing on the baby. The baby was a universe, the ultimate creative act. Now, looking back at that first postpartum year, I am reminded of the times in high school and college when my drinking was most out of control. I didn't care if I wore dirty clothes, blew every deadline, never talked to my closest friends. My son blotted everything else out. I was obliterated, and I liked it. I would have told you I was happy. The truth is, I had erased myself, just as I'd tried to with all those drinks. But this time, who would tell me to stop? Not the daycare waiting lists, or the lactation consultant who appeared minutes after I'd given birth. Not my mother, who loved that we'd found in the baby a common obsession. And certainly not the baby, whose life depended on mine, depending on his. At night, I'd often wake a few minutes before my son cried out. I'd stare into the darkness just outside my room until I heard him, "Yeah, yeah," when he was 4 or 5 months old, and then a full-throated cry loud enough for the neighbors to hear. I picked him up, sat down in the nursing chair, and in the dark, half asleep, listening to my son's whistling little swallows, I'd think of my mother's life after I was born. A year or so after postpartum, she fell for my sister's father. What would it be like to have the space in your mind, in your body, to fall in love with someone new, to make plans for restarting your life, to want something, to give your baby a bottle of formula, tuck her in, and go meet someone else in the backyard? Look at me, rocking in that chair for hours. Wasn't I a better mother? I felt angry sometimes when my son latched, angry for what I imagined I hadn't gotten. But didn't I also feel something else? Yes, I envied my mother. She'd held on to herself. It was the same damage, the same old stupid wound. I'd just found another way in. I wasn't erasing myself because I loved motherhood. The endless loop of caring for my infant, because all of that was enough for me. It was because I'd finally found what I was looking for. Someone who could never leave. My father lives on a small man-made lake. It's private, lovely and blue, with cottagey houses dotting its shores. Some of them quite large, others modest and shingled, all with docks that extend like tongues into the water. My husband and I pull up in his driveway. I change my son's diaper in the back seat, my pulse galloping. I'm nervous. I've never been here. I agonize over whether to introduce my father to my son. But in the end, we've come here almost on a whim. It's July. We're stir-crazy. And when we got an invitation, my husband and I decided it really wasn't a choice. My son, at 14 months, won't remember any of this. And isn't it true that I want to see it? See them together? My son looks more like me than he does his father. And I look more like my father than I do my mother. I want to see just how alike they are, measure it in real time. The brownness of their eyes, the angle of their smiles. My son isn't yet walking on his own, but he loves to explore with someone holding his hands. So my husband takes him around the wide lawn as my father offers us drinks. My father gets very invested in my husband's beer preferences and forgets to bring me a glass of wine. "Hummus," my son shouts, seeing the food on the patio table. He can't walk, but he can say dozens of words, and I wait for my father to notice this, to be proud. "Wow," his partner says, "he's a little talker." We sit down to eat. We're on a strict time limit, a couple of hours tops. My husband and I live and die by bedtime, 7:30 if we push it. Bedtime has given us our life back. Hours of kid-free time we use to write and read and watch shitty TV, or just stare into the sinkhole of our phones. When my son misses his, or worse, falls asleep in the car on the way home, we're in trouble. Multiple wake-ups and early morning. After dinner, my father wants to take us out on his pontoon, show us the lake. It's almost 6:30. Just for a minute, my husband and I agree, because the weather is beautiful, because my son does look like my father, because the pontoon is big and fancy, and the baby has never been on a boat before. We wrestle my son into a tiny life jacket. My father has one just about the baby size, as if he spends a lot of time with small children. The boat loops slowly around the lake as his partner carries out the conversation. "It's funny," my husband says. "He's such a guy." It was true. After so much wondering, the defining mystery of my childhood had turned out to be a regular man, a beer drinker and a country music fan who liked taking out his pontoon. If anything, my life makes less sense as his daughter, not more. This was not the story I'd imagined. The baby, balancing between my legs in his puffy orange vest, whines loudly. But I show him the water rippling behind the boat, and that, for a moment, changes his mood. "We should probably head back," my husband tells my father. "It's basically bedtime and we've got to drive." "Just one more loop," my father says, and then describes some special feature of the lake we can't absorb because the baby is trying to rip off his life jacket. And then he's whimpering, pulling at my shirt, but I can't nurse him on the boat with our life jackets on. And I'm not sure we can take them off. And I don't want to ask my father because I don't want to be rude or nurse in front of him. The boat keeps moving away from my father's house. "It will only take a minute," says my father, staring at a destination none of us can see. My husband gets out his phone. It's after 7 now, and my son is still fussing, too loud for any of us to talk. We reach the place where my father wanted so badly to go, the boat lulling for a moment near a small outcropping of sand, where a distant family runs in and out of the water. He glances at me as if to say, "See?" He's trying his best. Both of us are. But I don't know what I'm looking at. "I was so hopeful for you," I think, as my father finally turns the boat around. The next article is from The Archive, 1999. Disconcertion by David Samuels. I'm standing in my red, white, and blue Kill Rockstars t-shirt on the Griffiths runway, with tens of thousands of kids trudging past me, bearing knapsacks and suitcases, and kicking up dust like a herd of dispossessed extras in a made-for-MTV version of The Grapes of Wrath. Wandering through the carny landscape of empty pizza boxes are college kids on summer break, as well as their less fortunate peers who have taken long weekends off from their jobs, reshelving videos at Blockbuster outlets and serving the $5.99 breakfast at Denny's. Sullen, bare-chested guys push through the crowd with the elastic waistbands of their boxers pulled up hip-hop gangsta style above baggy shorts from Polo and Tommy Hilfiger. Bare midriff girls counter the dirty girl allure of their tight shorts and white and pink and blue baby doll t-shirts by hunching their shoulders and staring blankly down at the melting asphalt in the 90-degree heat. Lost in a haze of sexual discomfort that makes me feel like the worst moments of my adolescence have been captured in some highly concentrated form and sprayed out over the runway like cheap perfume. On the main stage, Woodstock 99 had officially begun. Looking up at the bright orange blimp hovering over my head, I wonder whether its message, fried dough, might be some kind of key to the deeper meaning of this event. If the original Woodstock was about peace, love, music, and making a good movie instead of a bad one, Woodstock 99 is about feeling the grease soak through the paper and onto your fingers. But the message of Woodstock 99 went something like this. Rock and roll is a moment of instant and lasting communion between the generations, a source of half-remembered trivia like the name of John Lennon's first wife, drifting through the pot-clouded haze of carpeted rec rooms with When the Levee Breaks by Led Zeppelin cranking through monster quadraphonic speakers as you make it for the second or third time with your high school girlfriend on the orange shad rug. In the heat and the dust, the past and present are one. As I walk through the artist's trailer park, I realize that Woodstock 99 is a perfect microcosm of the greater world beyond. Rock stars are wealthy, privileged people who live just like other wealthy, privileged people do, in places where the streets are quiet and safe, protected by gates and uniformed security guards from the danger, filth, and darkness of a world where everyone wants to be rich and famous and loved. They have come to Woodstock 99 because it's the biggest concert event of the summer, a place where they will be loved by 200,000 people. Instead, they find themselves penned up in a gated community of people like themselves, cut off from wherever it was they came from. On the last night, those hundreds of thousands of people start bonfires, the crowd ripping down sections of the media tower to feed the flames. The scene around me will be described in newspapers the next morning as a riot. Yet, what is happening now feels oddly light. The real riot happened over the last 3 days, not in a single chaotic explosive event, but as a slow-motion disintegration of the bonds that might hold so many people together. What happened isn't really that hard to describe. The crowd endured the heat and the sewage and the trash and the drugs until all that was left was the feeling of standing in a tired, dirty crowd of people at the end of the day and knowing that you're alone. What I think now is that safety is an illusion that we use to cover up some larger absence in our lives. The real causes of the Woodstock riot, if that's what it was, are larger than personal irresponsibility or bad music or poor planning or greed. The riot is a footnote to a larger story. 30 years ago, something vital and lasting, an idea of the good life and how to live it, what marriage meant, what to eat, what family and community were for, and of who was supposed to take care of the kids when the parents both work, broke apart. And now, 30 years later, that sense of connection, of some overarching narrative frame for our lives, still hasn't been repaired or replaced. The next article is called At the Summit, The Last Days of Davos, by Caitlin Doherty. Last January, along with all but 3,000 members of the global population, I was not invited to attend the World Economic Forum. This was a disappointment, and I had hoped to cover the event for this magazine. I wanted to travel to Switzerland during those 5 early days of the year to see whether globalization was dead, dying, or might yet recover from the blow delivered to it by a concatenation of historical events, the rearmament of the world, the return to an age of state industrial strategies, and the reassertion of national borders in the aftermath of a pandemic that had locked each of us for a while in place. As the cradle of the doctrine that had governed the world economy for the past 50 years, but was now, according to numerous reports, threatened by an apparent terminal polycrisis, the annual meeting of business and state leaders seemed to be the place to take globalization's pulse. Locked out, I wondered whether it might be enough to spend the week of the conference in a small alpine town, which the event has become synonymous, Davos. Davos is a Gemeinde, or township, in the Swiss canton of Graubünden, the easternmost and largest of the country, a region whose very heterogeneity mirrors that of the nation, earning it the nickname the Kleine Schweiz, Little Switzerland. Graubündners are renowned for their independence and resilience. The canton has long been at the very heart of Europe's trade networks, Its mountain passes facilitated the medieval exchange of English wool for Italian gold at the dawn of the continent's banking system. Its economy today is driven mostly by tourism. It is astonishingly beautiful. Pastoral agriculture and a mixture of biomedical research and chemical manufacturing. And Davos itself is a microcosm of this microcosm. A landscape of Burkean sublimity, whose rarefied air brought tuberculosis patients to its slopes for decades before the development of streptomycin began to empty out the sanatoriums, which over time refashioned themselves as hotels. In the wake of this heyday, Davosians sought never to rely so heavily on a single source of income again. Davos epitomizes two vying images of Switzerland, that of the global financial hubs Zurich and Geneva, upon which international business and the world's wealthy have long relied, and that of vertiginous dairy farmer landscaping, from which civic-minded cowherds descend from alpine peaks to cast their votes in referenda before returning to their butter churns. Both nations exist. The vast sums of capital that flow through the former provide the financial basis for the localism of the latter, helping to preserve the image of a land unspoiled by the vampiric thirst of capitalism and homogenizing cultural pressures of globalization. For decades, this neutral, unchanging national character has attracted a legion of global businesses and institutions that have headquartered themselves here. And for 50 years, alongside the ascendancy of globalization, the country did experience an extraordinary period of political and economic stability. But lately, even Switzerland has shown signs of increasing disturbance. The precise meaning of neutrality is up for grabs. Ought it allow, for instance, the Swiss Army to participate in NATO defense exercises? The country's two largest banks have not so much merged as one collapsed into the other. Its decision to unpeg the franc from the euro has stymied trade, and its most recent federal election saw a nationalist far-right party grow in its plurality in the National Council. It seems increasingly likely, as the forum approached, that the fate of the disintegrating liberal order might be divinable from the town it had long been its epicenter. Were their fates intertwined? There, in the local paper, printed alongside a letter from Klaus and Hilda Schwab, the WEF's patriarch and its matriarch, praising Davos as, quote, a place that naturally stimulates reflection, promotes dialogue, and supports the thorough, productive engagement that is essential to managing the challenges of our age, end quote, was the headline, "Is this the last Davos WEF?" No one I spoke to before my trip, however, not even the attendees from the previous year's forum, could tell me whether I'd be able to visit the town during the conference without some sort of clearance. Inevitably, most reports of Davos's character are made during the week of the forum, and thus, after a customary name check of the Magic Mountain, employ a vocabulary situated somewhere between that of a Pentagon briefing and an ad for an all-inclusive ski vacation, Fortress appears frequently, as do Sniper, Checkpoint, and Piano Bar. I read in the Times of India that nearly 5,000 Swiss Army personnel were deployed to secure the area, and on the website of the Swiss Federal Office of Civil Aviation that air traffic for some 50 kilometers around the center of Davos would be restricted to even hang gliders. The night before the forum began, I met Michael, a Swiss friend, for dinner in Zurich. Now a gymnasium teacher, he had been a teenage participant in 2003 demonstrations against the WEF at the height of the country's anti-globalization movement, when the police had prevented him and fellow activists from demonstrating at the airport. I asked him how long he had been detained. Swallowing a bite of Zucker Gershnitz veal simmered in cream sauce, he clarified, the cops hadn't arrested him. They just forced his group to return to the central train station. Then he had to wait a little while for a connection home to Bern. Security might have tightened somewhat since, I reasoned, but such an episode constituted an act of civil disobedience within modern Swiss history. It was a calming thought. The next day, after receiving similar assurances on the mid-morning Reichsbahn from a fellow passenger and kinesiologist named Cassilia, who was dressed in a Graubünden Tracht-style duck-egg blue frock and a small lace cap, who was on her way, uninvited, to show off her traditional costume to WEF attendees, I alighted to Davos Platz without being shot. In the history of capitalism, 1971 was the pivotal year that Richard Nixon ended the U.S. dollar's convertibility into gold, collapsing the post-war global monetary system and inaugurating an era of financial deregulation. In Switzerland, it was the year women won the right to vote in federal elections, and the nation began to overturn constitutional provisions from the 19th century that had been designed to limit the incursion of foreign actors. And in the midst of a tumultuous moment of reform and liberalization, when financial instability was becoming a new norm that required economic governance at a global scale, 1971 was the year Klaus Schwab hosted the first Davos. Schwab was born in Ravensburg, Germany, in 1938, to a German father and a Swiss mother. During the war, his father managed a factory that drew upon the forced labor of Nazi prisoners to produce military equipment. An engineer cum economist, who studied in Switzerland, Schwab decamped at age 28 for a sojourn at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, where he found a mentor in Henry Kissinger. Upon his return, he oversaw a merger of Escher Weiss, the Swiss industrial company where his father had worked and that had supplied flamethrowers to the Third Reich, and the Sulzer Group, a diesel engine manufacturer that had been blacklisted by the Allies during World War II for refusing to limit exports to the Axis powers. He thus returned to the obvious next project for a man of his professional expertise, writing an ethics manual for European businessmen. The first European Management Symposium, as the gathering was then called, was set up to promulgate his book's philosophy of stakeholder capitalism. It was a moderate success, enough to be repeated the following year, as the world teetered from, quote, Nixon shock, and then the next, when a band of Arab countries retaliating against the United States' decision to resupply the Israeli Defense Forces established an oil embargo on a slate of Western nations that spiked the price of American barrels by some 300%. It was in this year, 1973, that participants signed the Davos Manifesto, a clarion call for a new world order. The manifesto held that businesses were not only responsible for turning a profit, but also ought to, in the manner of governments, assume the role of a trustee of the material universe for future generations. It was therefore in the interest of society to ensure optimal conditions for the free market to flourish. By this point, the modern world, whose population had heretofore lived in distinct nations with their own economies, cultures, and customs, was merging into an increasingly integrated system, though one in which profit was still liable to be undermined by geopolitical scuffles. Schwab's event was where wealthy businessmen were beginning to assemble to make sense of this development. To cope with structural changes, genuine top executives must act as politicians, he wrote in 1975. That is to say, as foreign affairs and not domestic affairs politicians. In the ensuing years, Schwab's symposiums enticed representatives from more and more countries and larger companies, as Western markets specialized in search of cheaper manufacturing conditions. Davos expanded to include delegates from new continents too. Schwab invited Deng Xiaoping, to the 1979 meeting, though the Chinese Communist Party's vice chairman had the good sense to turn him down. A growing Chinese presence has since become a staple in the event. Driven by an inflated sense of his own prophetic powers, Schwab became increasingly interested in diplomacy as things took off at what eventually became the World Economic Forum. Early on, he endeavored to ease the embargo-related tensions between the Arab world and the West by inviting several hundred business leaders from each side to Montreux for a few days. In 1988, he persuaded the Greek and Turkish governments that war was perhaps not in their immediate interest when there were trade deals to be struck. Over the next decade, he welcomed Helmut Kohl, Nelson Mandela, and Hillary Clinton to the Davos stage, while also making the occasional stab at bringing peace to the Middle East. The concepts of what would become the cornerstones of the economic world order, the World Trade Organization and NAFTA, were said to have been developed at WEF-affiliated events. By 1998, when Louis H. Lapham filed two reports on the WEF for this magazine, Globalization and Its Political Sister, Third Way Politics, were at their acme. The new economically integrated system had wobbled, but withstood its first major shock, the Asian financial crisis. The Eurozone was a fait accompli, hovering on the cylindrical horizon, and the electoral triumphs of figures such as Bill Clinton and Tony Blair meant that, in most major Western states, even governments no longer claimed to be in the business of government. Instead, they were partners in governance with business. The global economy had been freed from the netting of politics, an antiquated pastime riddled with laws, parties, and voters, thereby enabling goods and capital to move freely toward new frontiers of profit, opportunity for the betterment of all. By the turn of the millennium, optimism about this project had dimmed. Multinational corporations were reaping ever greater windfalls, but there was little signs of the promised solutions to lingering problems of hunger, poverty, environmental degradation, and the like. An assemblage of conspiracy-worthy material had begun to amass around the WEF. Keynote speeches by Kissinger, Bill Gates, and George Soros. Michael Jackson's talking about children's rights in an address at a spin-off event in Namibia. And the presence of such famous mediocrities as Bono and Lionel Richie, and literary brown-nosers such as Paulo Coelho and later Ben Okri, all gave the impression that a cabal of wealthy elites was gathering in the Swiss Alps to run the world according to their own design. An image of Davos Man, a term popularized by Samuel P. Huntington in 2004, that referred to members of a transnational upper class who sought to disentangle themselves from the nuisance of national borders, a class for whom being a citizen of the world meant the freedom to move wealth from one offshore account to another with ease, people who talked big but said little was curdling. Davos Man had become a victim of his own success, too visible in the background of state and corporate handshake photos to hide from public criticism. A quarter of a century after Lapham's visit, we no longer live in Schwab's world. The rebounding consequences of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, the burst of the asset price bubble, the re-eruption of continental European warfare, and the emergence of China as an economic threat to American hegemony, to name but a few developments, have, to use a term beloved of WEF attendees, fractured the world. Ever since then, beginning in 2008, but with increasing enthusiasm since the pandemic and the WEF's misguided pivot to distributing the growth lifestyle insights to the plebs, owe nothing, eat bugs, etc., the consensus from Davos seems to be that the party is over. And yet, As the editor of The Economist pointed out on a WEF podcast in 2020, the safest thing to assume about Davos consensus is that it's wrong. Davos is an archetypical town in Switzerland, with its smattering of church spires rising above a low skyline of blocky, pastel-colored condominiums and a pyramidal structure of councils, large, small, and school. For 51 weeks of the year, it seems like the very model of a self-contained alpine community. But on the first day of the forum, as I made my way through the Congress Center, the cuboid wooden structure opened in 1969, where the official meetings take place, signs of the command of global capital, however subtle, accumulated quickly. Droves of delegates arriving for the WEF were disembarking from their trains via a temporary railway platform that had been built halfway between the permanent Davos Dorf and Davos Platz stations that bookend the town. A second-hand shop was shuttered, with the note in the window reading WEF Gerschlossen next to a pair of billboards advertising discount ski gear was another bearing the image of Narendra Modi, inviting you to immerse in India's vibrant culture through technology. A Methodist church displayed a banner of Christ washing a disciple's feet, inscribed with the words, Wirtschaft soll Menschen dienen, the economy should serve the people. Several streets away, its evangelical counterpart had rebranded the week as a crypto sanctuary. Pinned up at bus stops all over town were inkjet-printed flyers reading Stop WEF. A few meters past a building marked BlackRock, which looked as though it was normally occupied by a local coffee chain, the registration queue for the forum snaked around the entrance to a co-op supermarket. Behind it, the mountain light flowed over low-lying clouds, irradiating ski pistes on the facing valley wall. The slopes for the moment were empty. The gondolas halted, scattering a little snow as they swayed in place. The allure of the WEF, WEF to business English speakers, VEF to Schweizerdeutsch locals, and the source of the conspiracy theories that continue to surround it, has always been its twin promises, discreet facilities for an expedited schedule of private meetings and a high-profile lineup of speakers from across the public-private divide. If the crafting of cross-sectoral policy is the focus, the old guard of politics is still supposed to show up and burnish the forum with an aura of state power. And yet, on the political side, few major heads of state had bothered to attend. None showed up from the BRICS. Only Emmanuel Macron did from the G7. Instead, panels were filled with senior cabinet ministers and the leaders of small nations, each of whom mingled with the real stars. The names whispered in reports of sightings on the promenade, the town streets. People like Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, which hosted the week's most anticipated party, Julie Sweet, the CEO of Accenture, and the headliner, Sam Altman. Exceptions to the strengthening rule of political non-attendance could be found among the Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates in particular, something that became particularly evident to me on account of the fact that I spent a great part of the week following the proceedings to which I had not been invited from lush confines of the UAE Lounge, one of the state-run biennial-esque pavilions that line the rim of the WEF proper. With its free hot chocolate and platters of dates, it became a natural meeting spot for insiders and interlopers alike. It was the right place, I would realize, in which to register Schwab's observation. In his welcome address to the WEF congregation that, quote, geopolitically, our world is more interconnected, yet paradoxically, more divided than ever, end quote. The theme of the meeting was rebuilding trust. The lack of a grammatical subject served, if anything, to obscure the nature of the unprecedented challenges facing leaders of all stripes. Whose trust? In what? Was the problem the eroding trust between the global North and South? During one panel, Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda, observed that this might be a consequence of the former's vaccine hoarding and the post-COVID interest rate hike that many in the South are still paying for a very high price. A suggestion that was summarily dismissed by the then Dutch Prime Minister, now Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte. Was it trust in technological innovation and its capacity to deliver humanity from its self-imposed climate disaster? If so, the line of questioning chosen by WEF hosts was perplexing. Fareed Zakaria, after announcing that a panel he was about to chair would, quote, try to solve the problem of AI in 45 minutes, became fixated on learning from Altman why it could not yet drive his car. Or had trust been lost in institutions like the WEF itself, and in sorts of premises that were espoused on the stages, namely that the complexity intrinsic to multipolarity was something that could be managed by participants, or that the crises of this unique juncture in American history, in human history, excuse me, might be overcome if only the WEF attendees could reestablish trust in each other, said Schwab. One had to wonder if the reason the WEF's relevance had so diminished was because top brass couldn't justify time spent answering questions as asinine as WEF President Borg Brenda's about the Houthis' motivations for drone attacks on commercial shipping lanes in the Red Sea. How connected is this with the war in Gaza? He asked. Or, perhaps, they could no longer truly buy into the notion that the frictionless movement of goods and capital was a sufficient bulwark against such economic disruptions, let alone something that could solve as protracted a crisis as Israel's genocide of the Palestinians, which, as the finance minister of Qatar reminded participants, was slowing down the economy of the entire region. A year ago, this forum coined a word, polycrisis, Colombian President Gustavo Petro declared erroneously on day three. And yet, somehow, the situation has become worse. In 2024, fracturing could describe not only the world outside, but the state of dialogue within the forum itself. The only premise that most of the headline speakers could agree upon was that the world the WEF had been born into was gone. It had not been held together as planned by cross-sectoral partnerships, stakeholder engagement, multilateral diplomacy, or the holistic economic system of profit-seeking specializations hawked by Davos Man. We are between orders, so we don't really know what the new order will be, said Brende. Hopefully, he added, it would not be the jungle growing back, but something based on international law and the UN Charter. Davos is in recession, Mark Malak Brown told me over the phone from within the securitized conference center on the WEF's second day. At the time, the president of the Open Society Foundations and overseeing the leadership transition from Soros's pair to fee, he was blunt about the present state of affairs. Quote, for many years now, you've had, almost back-to-back, Davos and then the Munich Security Conference, which is the security policy gathering that would be held the following month, just a stone's throw away over the Zugspitze. And, for a long period, Davos was seen as a much more contemporary event. Munich harked back to a Cold War world, while Davos, with globalization and market integration in partnership with liberal values, seemed to have the zeitgeist. But now, he said, an awful lot of people prioritize Munich, because suddenly security has jumped to the top of the line. Ukraine, Gaza, also conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. Elite anxiety was now much more fixated on that geopolitical agenda than on the more corporate one here. Indeed, none of the participants I spoke to could explain the relationship between the political headline acts and the lazy Susan of corporate meetings. Only one event seemed illuminating on the subject, the address of Volodymyr Zelensky, who refrained from asking for more weapons and instead talked about the need for investment in his country, something he has endeavored since the start of the war to make more attractive to international companies by suppressing unions and promoting corporate land ownership. This plea seemed quite obviously linked to the presence of Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, and an assiduous pro-Ukraine hawk, who met with Zelensky for a closed-door conversation that same afternoon, along with asset management executives from Blackstone, BlackRock, and Bridgewater Associates. For this part of the schedule, I stationed myself in Ukraine House, a building a short walk from the bakery that served as Russia House until 2022, when the WEF was forced to comply with EU-led Swiss wartime sanctions and excised the Kremlin and many of its associated billionaires, longtime fixtures of the Davos party circuit, from the proceedings. The speech was screened across the back of a stage set up for panels later in the day, and the room was sparsely occupied. When Zelensky finished, it began to fill for the next event, Women at War, Redefining Strength and Resilience, during which Ukrainian veterans and medics described overcoming gender stereotypes to participate in their country's defense. Love will save the world, concluded one speaker. The crowd applauded, and the Canadian executive of a vodka brand turned to her neighbor to declare that we have to get Ukraine in front of the right people. For Christy Hoffman, the head of UNI Global Union, an international labor federation, the purpose of the forum was clear: networking. There's no more efficient way than to come to Davos and meet with four CEOs in the course of 2 days, you know. We can't do that in any other setting. Arnaldo Andre Tinoco, the foreign minister of Costa Rica, disclosed to me an ongoing case in his country's constitutional court brought by Huawei after President Rodrigo Chavez signed a law blocking the Chinese tech conglomerate from supplying 5G infrastructure to the country. 2 days earlier, the government had announced a new CHIPS Act partnership with the Biden administration. But despite reports that the scale of the Chinese delegation in Davos was ruffling feathers on the Antony Blinken-led American side, this proxy scuffle did not seem to have any bearing on Tinoco's presence at the WEF, which he too characterized as mostly good for meetings. Later that evening at an LGBTQ event, the Taoiseach of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, entered without any of the revelers seeming to notice. Were people here really so nonchalant about the presence of world leaders at Eurodisco ski chalet parties, or did he lack the star power of a middle-aged Arizonan called Stan, around whom all the guests seemed to orbit? I took the chance offered by Varadkar's social neglect to ask what benefit his presence at Davos might afford to Ireland. There are lots of Americans present, he observed, so it was a pretty convenient way of having meetings. The day after, on the benches inside the local Migros cafeteria, an exhausted British journalist on her third tour of the forum summed up her impression of events inside the Congress Center. Speed dating for CEOs. In May, some half a century after the inaugural symposium, the WEF announced that the now 86-year-old Schwab would be stepping down from the helm of the organization, with full executive responsibility to be assumed by Brende. Schwab had been correct in his last opening sermon. The world is both more divided and interconnected than ever. But he was wrong to conclude that this is a paradox. For some at Davos, the fracturing of the global economy has been an unrivaled opportunity to better integrate with the great states of old and the icons of multinational capital. Such has been the path of the United Arab Emirates, whose pride of place in the promenade last January feels, in retrospect, neither coincidental nor surprising. Not coincidental, because representatives of the Emirates, a federation born at the very end of that auspicious year in 1971, when it cut loose from the ailing British Empire just in time to get rich from the embargo-instigated spike in oil prices, were the darlings of the forum, praised throughout for being among the few winners of the multipolar polycrisis. And unsurprising, because if the WEF is an event designed to expedite commercial connections between business and government, while remaining bland and noncommittal on matters of world affairs, then this has also been the exact model through which the United Arab Emirates has thrived in these recent years. Court American and Chinese investment, allow Russian oil to flow, throw money at tech unicorns, establish numerous semi-autonomous, corporate-friendly zones, and above all, keep goods moving. Brenda's search for a new world order on the basis of the UN Charter is off to a false start. A new habitat for Davos Man is already forming in the model of the Emirati Free Zone. The natural consequence of the project is to safeguard the private accumulation of profit from political interference. As this magazine arrives on newsstands, business and state leaders gather once again in a small town at the heart of Europe to try to divine the future of globalization. The program was mooted in October at an even more restricted gathering, the WEF's annual meeting of the Global Future Councils, held in that desert oasis where capital moves freely, unencumbered by income taxes, trade unions, or democratic processes. Dubai. Thank you for listening.